Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 242, an introduction to Vajra Yoga.
So welcome, everybody. I'm very, very happy to start this course. And it's a more or less a full moon, which is auspicious. And but it doesn't matter what the phase is, we'll make it auspicious. And I've been wanting to do this for some time. And I give all credit to Michelle Lowe for organizing and pushing and pulling it together and inspiring this. And I really do. And I wanted her to give it the first welcome, in fact. But she gave it online. She sneaked in and gave it online to many of you. So she didn't want to repeat it. And she surprised me completely. It was without consultation. She jumped to the famous Lama Chöpa, which my translation of the Lama Chöpa, which in Tibetan means offering to the guru, to the teacher, to the mentor, from an earlier book I did. And I also did it in this book, Essential Tibetan Buddhism. And she read from that because she wanted to emphasize something that we want to share over these hundreds of hours, or however long it takes. Which is that the nice thing about Buddha and Buddhism, and actually Indian religions and Indian traditions in general, is that for some reason the Indians were a little less scared of God after the Vedic period. After Buddha's period, they were not so scared of their gods. And actually, they rather liked them. They developed bhakti, where they loved them. They also believed that their gods loved them. But not in the Vedic period. Vedic period, they were scared. They did sacrifice and ritual all the time. But they did. And so the idea that a human, through practice, could become godlike, even in the theistic forms of Indian spirituality, were sort of cool. They were into that, like be Vedanta, you could be Brahma. Then some Brahmins who were nervous about, they wanted to keep their hierarchy, so they said, well, yeah, you can be near Brahma, you can't really be Brahma. They backed down from Shankaracharya's great Brahma, you know. People like Ramanuja and Madhva, they got into qualified non-dualism, and then they got into dualistic non-dualism. Indians are so brilliant philosophically always, and the language is so good for philosophical and scientific thinking. Sanskrit is. And so, in the case of Buddhism, Buddha's whole thing, once he became a Buddha, was not really to be worshipped by other people, but it was for other people to be Buddha too. That was his entire thing. And He surprised everybody, including himself, when he did attain what they call unexcelled perfect enlightenment, realistic perfect enlightenment, we can even say. He was astonished at the nature of reality. That reality, when you discover it, and this is sort of a foundational point of our whole course, when you discover reality, it is excellent. It is wonderful. It loves you, reality. It's not necessarily an old tribal patriarch. It's not necessarily only a great mother, but a little bit more like a great mother than an old tribal patriarch, just like a mom tends to love you more than dads do. Although dads try, and they're good too. But moms are really the ones, you know, because dads don't just bear them, you know. And so they're a little more disconnected from it. So when he discovered that reality, he was amazed. He had expected whatever, you know, he'd been working at it very intensively for many years, many lifetimes. And when he discovered how wonderful it was, how free it was, etc., he was smiling from ear to ear, you know. He had that really big grin that you often see on Buddha statues, not always, but some cultures depict Buddha looking a bit serious. But mostly you see that big smile. And why was that? Because he discovered that reality is bliss. And when you know that, you are bliss. When we suffer, it's because we don't know what it is, and we are trapped in unreality. And we're struggling with it, and fighting with it, and afraid of reality. And but reality itself is bliss. But he was clever about people. He didn't announce that right away, at least not to the humans around him, because he knew that they would be suspicious, because we do suffer, ordinary us, and if someone comes and tells us it's all bliss, we tend to like, wait a minute, what are you trying to sell me, the Brooklyn Bridge or what? In other words, we're skeptical. So all he said was, he didn't hide it, he just said it's the freedom from suffering. It's the cessation of suffering, freedom from suffering, no more suffering. So that was sort of the conservative, minimalist way of saying bliss. You know, later on he definitely said bliss. And to certain people even right away. So, but the other thing was, of course, he said, anything I say about it, and that's why it was so surprising to me, because what I discovered was something that I couldn't fit. The reason it was surprising was it couldn't fit in any of my previous concepts of it would be this or that, you know. Even bliss, what I thought what might be bliss, it doesn't fit in that. Although then bliss is the closest word, or freedom from suffering is the closest thing I can say about it. But the problem I have with you guys is, I can't really explain it to you. I can't. I experienced it. It is fantastic. It is beyond explanation. Because explanation uses concepts in dualistic language. And that doesn't mean it's useless. It's incredibly valuable. It brought me to the brink. But it can't capture it. So right away you have to make this, you know, you have to be clear that you can't just pick it as a formula and say, well, it's bliss or it's nirvana or it's this or that, and then that'll settle it because you'll believe that. No, it will surpass whatever concept you try to put on it. Reality does. And but he said, part of my experience of it is that I know all of it. I know all about it. I know all about all of you. I'm completely one with the vast infinite reality. My body is a reality body. It's infinite. It's not just this bag of skin or what's inside this bag of skin. I'm going to keep staying in this relative bag of skin for a while, because then I can stay close with you, because you used to know me and you'll know, oh, that's Siddhartha, then he became Buddha and so on, and he looks a little funny now. And I would say Buddha probably looked like, from the description, he looked like Spock or Kirk or McCoy, or Picard, actually, because the better transporter room is in the new Star Trek engine, you know, like ships. And in those transporters, when they beam out, there's a moment where their body is just sparkles. You see that perimeter of their body, and it's just sparkling, and then they disappear, right, because they've... ideas, they transfer themselves into atoms and molecules and rays, and they get sent off somewhere. And then they reassemble, is the notion in the transporter beam, right? So Buddha was half transporter beaming at all times, I think, because they have a story about some painters who tried to paint him. He was sitting for them because his friend, the king, in that country wanted to send a portrait to Persia, to his friend who was a king in Persia. And so the guy couldn't come to India and he couldn't go there. So he wanted to send a painting of the Buddha. So they tried to paint him, but they couldn't paint him. It was too difficult to see this sort of coruscating, bright, luminous entity. So Buddha then had an idea because he wanted them to be able to paint him. So he said, come to see me on the next windless day over on this part of the palace grounds. I'll come in from my monastery to those grounds and meet me there. And they said, okay. They didn't quite know what he had in mind. But what it was he went and sat on the other side of one of those big pools, like in front of the Taj Mahal, you know, the big, big tank, what they call in India, marble tank with water. And then the very still, no wind. And so they could look in his reflection in the water, and the water dampened the shining, you know, the rays and the whole sort of changing, you know, metamorphosing energy field that was his supposedly coarse body, his emanation body, they call it in Buddhism. So Buddha said, I am there and I know all about all of you. And what I know is that you too can experience it. But not just from listening to some slogan that I say or some concept that I give you. There is a path you can follow to unlearn and to critically overcome the network of concepts based on a misunderstanding of reality, ignorance, that has you trapped in thinking that you're separate from the universe and that you're having a fight with it to dominate and get more of it, to own your own, or to fight it off from trying to dominate you, you know, and then time rolling and getting old and then fearing death and sickness and old age and all this sort of thing. And so that's because you have a wrong, you have a wrong understanding of what you are in connection to that reality. And so it's the process of critically seeing through this false perception that you have, and then gradually opening the blinders kind of away from your vision and opening your mind and heart to reality. And then you will experience it. You can, because it is you, and you inevitably will experience it because it is you and it is reality. And unreality can always be peeled off of reality, and reality doesn't peel. Reality is just there. And it's actually what you're made of, reality. Okay? And the world is made of that. Everything in the world. So it's all one reality, really. Which supports all its differences, its nice differences, the differences that are helpful and friendly, because it's not an underlying oneness that is outside of it that somehow supports it. It is itself, both the differentiated relational things and the ultimate reality. It's like absolute relativity. And when you know that, then your sense of being apart from it is much lighter, and you can surf it and you can deal with it. And you can enjoy it blissfully, apparently. So that's what he said. So that forced him, you see, to be a kind of educator, actually. And he presented what he understood not as something that people had to believe, like a religious thing, like, oh yeah, I met God, he told me to believe in him, he'll save you, which is, and I'm his emissary, you know, that's what usually the religious founders does, you know, they introduce you to the savior. But Buddha said, there is no savior. There are a lot of saviors, actually, who are working to help you, but they can't complete the job because none of them are omnipotent, because you have your own power. So you are your own savior, actually, if you understand that. And then, of course, once you save yourself, you can help save others, too, and you become one of the many saviors and helping people. But there's just no one thing that's going to do. You can't look outside for that. You can look outside for help, and you should. But not for the final salvation, for the liberation, for the nirvana. Now, you'll note that my cessation and freedom, those terms that I use to describe it, are negations. And that's because you need negation to critique what you think is reality, which is this difficult situation of you versus everything else, where you're losing all the time, because it's more than you are, right? It's really simple, right? And actually, I discovered that, like a scientist, by my experience. I didn't come up onto a slogan that I'm going to start say, and then you say it, and then we all say it, and we keep saying it, and if we say it, that'll make it so. No, it doesn't work like that. It's an experience, you know, because we have to find our own reality, and our reality encounters everything else is reality. It's because it's the same as it. Do you get it? Something like that. Okay? So then Michelle, in welcoming the people online, and hopefully you'll get to see that. I don't know the electronics involved. But earlier this afternoon, sitting on a nice porch with our favorite friend Hanuman and Ganesh. We particularly love Hanuman, you know, because he helps bring on Shambhala. Did you know that? KD loves Hanuman, for just in general, but he also loves Tibetan things because he discovered to his amazement that Hanuman helps bring Shambhala out on the planet, you know, a few hundred years from now, whenever it happens. Or even now, if we understood it now, it would happen. You know? So, Michelle was there, and then she read that verse. She read this verse. And she just, I wanted her to do it again, but she didn't want to repeat it. So it says, it's from the Lama Chöpa, which comes from, which is a Tibetan work written by one of the Panchen Lamas, the greatest first Panchen Lama, who created the Dalai Lama guy, you know. And but it's based on an Indian text from Buddha, called the Vajra Rosary Tantra. And the first, very first verse, because it's a, you know, it's offering to the mentor, or we say worship, but the chapa actually means make puja, you know, make an offering. And here's the first verse. It says, and this is what you recite when you practice this yoga. It says, through the great bliss state, I myself become the mentor deity. So right away, when you're just starting to study, you become the guru. You imagine that you do. From my luminous body, light rays shine all around, massively blessing beings and things, making the universe pure and fabulous, perfection in its every quality. So why Michelle read that, to my surprise and delight, is that it sort of underlines, from 2,000 years later, this thing about the guru in this tradition wants you to be the guru, because they're not just teaching you, they want you also to teach others. And again, it's not converting others. And this is a very important point I want to mention right before we read the Heart Sutra together, which we will do. I want to really emphasize this point. It doesn't mean converting them to Buddhism. In Buddha's own time, there was no Buddhism to convert them to. There was just India, and people got so turned on by the prospect that he offered what they could learn, what they could unlearn and then learn, that they dropped everything, including their clothes and their hairdo, and their job, and their family if they had, but mostly they were seekers, so they didn't have families. And he had left his family, actually, 6 years earlier to be full-time, you know, all the time. And he said he would come back for them and he would do something better for them, which actually he did. But it was quite painful for them when he left. And father also was very upset because he left at a time when he was about to inherit the throne of the kingdom. And the father wanted to retire because, you know, not so long a lifespan. And that was the system. When your son had a son, when you were the king, then you could abdicate and he would become, the crown prince would be king, and then his son the crown prince. And it would go on like that. So then you'd get some time in retirement, because India was always quite spiritual. And so the dad said, okay, great, son, you're going to take over and I'm going to retire. And Buddha said, no, I'm sorry, Dad. You have to hang in there. I'm retiring. I'm not taking this role. I'm going to go find enlightenment. And father was really upset. But I don't want to get into that story in length. But what I wanted to say is this. The Dalai Lama was a little bit in a film on David Bohm, the physicist, who was a friend of his. And I happened to see it as an online premiere because I was on a panel that answered questions and discussed it after the film. And I was so pleased because he said it so clearly. He always says it when he gives talks in America or Europe or anywhere other than Tibet or with his own people. He says that he doesn't want to convert them to Buddhism. He gives even teachings, and he says, well, I'm not doing this to convert. And he said it very clearly in that film. He said, in my entire life, he said, I have never given Buddhist teaching with an intention of making people into Buddhists, he said. And they're like, I'm proud of that type of thing he's just saying. And he really means it, too. And the reason he means it is that he believes in this time of history. Buddhism, you can't actually say in history, in the past, that Buddhism was not kind of a missionary tradition. Because Buddhism, the religious side of Buddhism was created by those who couldn't really do the education, but liked the people who did. So they supported the institutions that were, you know, the monastic universities that, or the Zen centers or whatever it was, where people were meditating and learning and studying and critiquing their ignorant worldview and finding a realistic one. And that they, for them, it was kind of like a religion, like they believed what they were doing was good, and they felt they couldn't necessarily do that in that life. But the ones who were really using it were really exploring reality like scientists, and they were educating and uneducating and educating themselves massively, over millions of them over thousands of years, to a great effect. And so you can't say, in other words, that. And actually, when I first heard Dalai Lama do it, was in Harvard Divinity School. He had said something to me about it before, way back in India, before we brought him there. But at Harvard Divinity School, he said to the people there, the theologians assembled, and I was trying to say, you don't need to do that, but he was doing. He said, I want you to know I don't believe in God, he says. And they were like, what? And I had to translate. No, I wasn't really translating, but here and there he would break into it, and I was a bit translating that time. And then he said, and why do I tell you that? Because if you might get to like me if you didn't know that. And then later, once we were friends, if you discovered I didn't believe in God, you might faint. He said, and then he said, I have gone through a thing, thanks to Thomas Merton originally, he said, and since then other Christians that I have met, where I used to think Buddhism was better. And, you know, they were kind of childish who believed in a Father God, you know. And I used to think that, and that sort of Buddhists do kind of think that, he was admitting. But then he said, however, now since I met Merton and then other people, I disagree with that. And I think that they can get to the place, the reality, their own way. And for some, maybe the personal God idea is good, better even, than a non-personal God or different types of things. And so I no longer presume that. And I don't, you know, but I want you to know that right up front. And then, of course, he said to them, which is, of course, they can't really agree with the way their current theologies are stacked up in Christianity. He said, I do believe in this day that we're all intermingled in this global pluralistic world where in one city you have every conceivable religious institution within a few blocks of each other, all different religions. We can't be competing to convert people, or it will create terrible conflict in the future. This was long before the moral majority, you know, the rise of the religious right in America, and then the Ayatollah in Iran, and the fundamentalisms, and the ISIS, you know, crazy stuff. In all of the traditions, fundamentalism, not just in Islam, but all of the traditions, sort of Islam, the most spectacular one lately. But it was long before that, and he said, this will bring terrible trouble if we don't try to look into our founders' teachings and our theologies and realize that what's good for me may not be good for you, and to therefore leave the other ones alone and not try to convert, not to compete for converts. And he really meant it. And I must admit, when he would tell me that, I would kind of, because I loved Buddhism so much. And I wasn't really a proper Christian. I didn't really believe in a creator, and I didn't like religious piety. I had a thing. I was not into like rituals and like, and I still don't like sanctimonious behavior on the part of spiritual people. And you know, I like it sort of down to earth thing, you know. And so I discovered that with the Tibetans and with their wonderful, you know, theologies or Buddhologies, let's say. And so I thought it was a bit better. I really did. And so I said, yes, yes, Your Holiness. But I didn't completely agree with him until about 15, 20 years ago. I had this dream. And in the dream, I was sort of out in a big tent somewhere in a mega church, like maybe, or a preacher's tent. And they were, might have been black church, maybe, because they were very animated, the people. They were, you know, like, oh yeah, I feel the spirit, you know, like, I feel saved, you know, like the kind of thing. And they're very lively, you know, and energized, you know, jumping up, you know, like having kind of kundalini of their own style, you know. And then going, Jesus, Jesus, you know. And then I realized that Avalokiteshvara is the great bodhisattva who is considered the incarnation of the compassion of all Buddhas. So it's definite Buddha savior figure, sometimes female, sometimes male, different embodiments, not just one embodiment, but still, that's basically the guy or the girl if he's in a female form. And somehow some voice said in the dream, or maybe my own voice, in the dream as I was waking up, it said, he really means it. He's happy they're being saved by Jesus. Why on earth would he want them to be saying, I'm saved, Avalokiteshvara, a name they couldn't pronounce? Jesus is two syllables, it's so easy. No problem. You know, I swear, it was like an epiphany. So then I realized that His Holiness was 100% serious, and I'm 100% serious about that. And it's hard because, you know, I talk about Buddha, you know, and Buddhist knowledge and Buddhist science. So people think Buddhism, yeah, okay, that's a religion, I'll be Buddhist. I don't care. If you already are Buddhist, that's all right. As I tell Dalai Lama, please don't feel bad, Your Holiness. You didn't convert me from Christianity. I was really not religious before. I was maybe a spiritual seeker, but I wasn't religious. I didn't believe, especially in the soul creator. I definitely did not believe in that. I like Jesus, but I still do. I liked him more from having learned about Buddhism, actually. But the point is, this course, our teacher training, is to fit two points. Another story I wanted to tell you today. I once met a very distinguished Lama, I won't mention names, in Bhutan, 30 years ago maybe. And I had, at that time recently, several friends of mine who had taken long retreats, I think one for 6 years, one for three, maybe one, maybe both for six, I can't remember. But terrible things happened to them. One of them was killed in an auto accident. The other one was, like, you know, having difficult living somewhere, working as a carpenter or whatever it was. In other words, it wasn't really working out for them after this marvelous long retreat. And, you know, the 3 year, 3 month, 3 day retreat, which is a total isolation retreat, which is not the way we're doing it. People were taken out of their ordinary life setting to go and do that kind of retreat, which has its place, which is worthwhile. But, you know, they maybe weren't quite Buddhas yet. They were close, they'd made progress, but they were not there. And then they had a lot of problems. And so I said to that Lama, you know, I'm very worried. There were a few other stories like that. So I said to him, you know, you guys are having a lot of people doing these long retreats, and I think it's great. But I wish you would focus on the fact that after they finish, we don't know what they're going to do. They don't know what they're going to do. And the time they spend doing it, if they're young and have the money to do it, to support themselves while doing it and pay the fees and the, you know, whatever, the rent, then that's their schooling time when they sort of find their way of making a living in life. And so why don't you implement a policy? And the thing is, they don't, even after 3.5 or 6 years, they still don't speak Tibetan that well because they're on retreat, so they're not hanging out chatting with people. Even though they learn enough to read some text, they couldn't teach in a Tibetan monastery, and you don't have that many, and you have your own Tibetan teachers anyway. And so, although they're supposed to be Buddhas, they're not going to be teaching in your monastery. And then they come back here, and then, so I'm enlightened, they can tell the world, but that doesn't give them a job. Some will maybe form a group, like a Dharma center or a cult, or write some books and become famous, maybe a few. But most of them will be living in grandma's attic 15 years from now, and they won't have a thing. So why don't we do it this way? You identify the people you think are the really good candidates. we go to Naropa, and I was a younger professor those days at Columbia, and I said, I'll help, and we'll create a special graduate program for them, get them an MFA, or MA, and then they go in for either the PhD to be an academic. I didn't realize then there wouldn't be enough academic jobs. So I thought, and I was doing that, so I thought that's one outlet. And the other one is to be a therapist, which is really, there are a few long retreatants in some of the traditions who are really successful therapists and really have helped a lot of people. That's a wonderful thing, and they can make a living that way. And so then they do the retreat as field work. And then they write it up after the retreat, and they get whichever kind of degree they want. What do you think? Oh, that is great. I've been worrying about it myself, he said, this elder lama. And there were some younger ones there who were operating those retreat centers, and he ordered them to do this, but nobody ever did anything. You know, I was unable. I don't have $1 zillion. I wasn't able to do it. And I've always wanted to do it. So what this is, Michelle and Richard and Mary have trained a lot of people, and then people form yoga studios, and they don't necessarily convert people to Hinduism, actually, in those studios. They just teach them how to take care of their body and health, and a few maybe go to India or something, or they under their own tutelage, they become kind of devotees of Krishna or whoever it may be, Patanjali, something like that. Maybe they do, or maybe they don't. Maybe they become Chris's, Jew Boos, Hin Boos, you know, all these different things. Because Dalai Lama wants, if you already are a Buddhist, any of you, that's okay. I am, sort of. But on the other hand, if you already are, you and your family isn't, then, you know, you should really make a place in your heart for whatever they do. When you visit them, maybe go to their church or their synagogue or their temple or whatever and be respectful about it and try to encourage them that they are on the path. That's great. And of course, you're teaching them something about life just by being nice and good and caring. But especially, as the Dalai Lama says, everyone should stay with their grandmother's religion, because otherwise grandma will be too unhappy. That's what he says. My grandma's gone, so I don't have to worry. And you know, younger people, this is the point. So what this teacher training is not to convert, although we'll be talking a lot about Buddhism and automatically also about Hinduism, because yoga, because the Indian knowledge in general, the culture and civilization of India, we see as a higher culture actually than the Euro-American culture, in fact, because we see it as teaching people, you know, based on their inner realizations of their high spiritual leaders, ways in which you can operate your own body in a more pleasant and healthful and energized way and live your life more beneficially for yourself in the short term and also help more helpful to others and you know, health, prosperity, kindness, and spiritual advancement by serving others. They had it better worked out, we feel. And you can point to India today with all its problems, but remember, it was conquered by other cultures, extractive European ones, colonial cultures, for 1,000 years. Actually, the Muslims were maybe better, because the first 500 or 600 were Muslim invaders, but they settled down in India, at least, so they circulated the wealth within the country after the first violent invasion and domination. But after that, they sort of settled down in the country. But then the British and the European, the Portuguese, et cetera, Dutch, French, British, and finally mostly British, they extracted tremendous amount of wealth from India. It was the jewel in the crown of the British Empire. And so it's a lot of the difficulties come that they still haven't recovered. They've been independent now for 60, 70 years, and they're beginning to assert their own culture. But still, they are run by people who are kind of trained by the British. And even they're in the subcontinent as one country, in a way, is sort of a leftover of the colonial thing, because the Tamil people, the Kerala people, the Bengali people, the Punjabi people, they're really different nations of many tens of and even hundreds of millions. The Punjab, the UP is like 200 million people, you know, more or less one nation, for example, one of the biggest in the world by itself. And so by being a kind of leftover of an empire, with their parliament buildings and everything having been built by British, they're still, you know, they still haven't recovered the local culture that Gandhi wanted them to cultivate, you know, with his spinning wheel, the whole thing. Okay? So I would say that if one says, well, there's a greater spiritual knowledge and we honor India for that, and we look to India for an inner science, Dalai is very strong on that, and the materialistic sciences maybe need the balancing of these inner sciences to control the exterior sciences that manipulate nature in such a way so as to magnify greed in the form of consumerism that is polluting the planet to death, and hatred in the form of militarism that could be blowing the planet up at any moment. And so we are looking for cultural difference. So when one makes a yoga center in an American city, let's say, or a Mexican one or a Colombian one, it is a cultural difference. You know, one is not making religious intrusion, although some people will see it that way, but one is honestly making a cultural innovation, which will interact a lot with the health system, actually. Because when people learn yoga well in numbers, they will have better health. And therefore, it's preventive. So then the doctors, if they think they're doing a business rather than a service, they will make less money. But it takes a long time for that, so they won't be so upset about that. So that's a key point, okay? Then second, on the preliminary prospectus of this teacher training, I made a big fuss about basic Buddhism, because of its ethics, because Buddhism basically is said to be three things in its own literature. It has three bodies of literature, which one is called Vinaya, and one is called, they used to say three baskets because the way they kept the books. So Vinaya, Sutra, and Abhidharma. And then that's called the verbal Dharma or textual Dharma. And then the Dharma in practice, the actual Dharma, what it is three educations. And the educations are Adishiksha, Trini Adishikshani, or Adisikani in Pali, you know. And these are education in ethics, a higher education in ethics, higher education in mind, which involves meditation and also psychology, not only meditation, also exploring the mind psychologically, and healing its traumas and things. And then education in science, really, or they call it wisdom, which means discovering the nature of reality. So those are the three, that's really what it is, the three educations. So we're going to make a big fuss about that. Of course, it's very similar to the ethics of other traditions, but it has a kind of interesting biological basis in the theory of karma. The Indian one does, and Buddhism has the sort of the easiest way of teaching that. So we're going to spend a lot of time on that. Today, coming over here, my beloved wife came along with us, Nena, who is the founder and the real executive of Menla, creator of Menla, with the help of lots of friends and a few employees. And she said, well, it's good, you talk to them. Well, yes, so training teacher, yes, Buddhism is good. You should tell them about how to learn to manage their emotions, she said, because that's really what it is. It isn't so much being religious or something. It's like, so when someone does or says something, you don't react and freak out. So then I invited her to teach, but she steadfastly doesn't want to do. And she would say, I'm supposed to be the mouthpiece, you know, I'm like one of those like mob lawyers or something, you know. The real powers are like Nina and Michelle and others, and I'm just a mouthpiece, you know. But that's okay, I'm happy to serve, I really am. And the point is I said she should teach because she's better at not reacting than I am. I'm still, after all these years, a little trigger a bit easily. And but compared to how I was before, I'm quite mild, believe me. So I was educated playing lacrosse, you know, and WASPy education, you know. So I had an older brother who used to beat me up, so I had to, like, frighten him by being more fierce because I wasn't as strong. So anyway, that's that. So I want to talk a lot about that, and the ethical thing is what in this first section we have three major sections, I believe, and over the next period of time, it's not 3 years, but it's some long time, and a lot of study in between. And in this first section, I'm going to focus on these basic things, although there are some of them, some part of the basic things, the wisdom part especially, and the compassion part, are quite quite advanced and quite powerful, actually. So it takes a bit of doing and a bit of meditating. So that's what we're going to focus on in these 10 days. But back to the sort of overall thing. So what you could get out of this, hopefully, is more enlightened. You become more enlightened. I always say I'm not enlightened, and that's true, and I don't pretend to be. But I have to say I am a bit more enlightened than I was when I started. And I think my good wife and children will admit that, to different ones and to a different degree, and different degrees. And also I've had a kind of glimpse of the goal that is quite visceral, and I hope to get there soon. But I'm not pretending that I live at the goal quite. But in a way, I can imagine that I do, and that helps me actually. That's part of the an advanced practice, you can say. Once you have a little understanding of selflessness or emptiness, then you can use your imagination that way, and that is helpful because it's a slow. Everything is slow and gradual. You know, there are some people who say, oh, this weekend you come and do this, you'll be enlightened at the end of it. That's fake. And they can point out the goal in a weekend, but then they always have, oh, then the preliminaries, then you might have to do 300,000 prostrations, which is like yoga major calisthenic, you know, like full prostration on the ground to try 1,000 of them even. It's quite strenuous. And so it's very gradual, but there are sometimes quantum leaps, like you can have epiphany type insights for sure. And those are rare to be welcomed and wonderful, you know, but not to be grasped at, like, oh, now I had an epiphany, you know, especially this business, the really key business of emptiness, the great medicine, Buddha's great medicine, like a medical concoction, which is the yoga of emptiness. Which is like a healing medicine for all the afflictions and addictive emotions that we have. People can have, when they really focus on it, they can have experiences as if they sort of disappear into empty space. And it's a little bit scary. They can overcome a little fear when they get on the edge of that. And then they can viscerally go there and have an experience like that. And then they feel that since they overcame the slight fear of it, maybe some people bigger fear, they feel that that's enlightenment, and they're then enlightened. And then they go around behaving strangely, you know, because they wrongly and nihilistically misunderstand emptiness, thinking that it's somewhere else. Instead of the space-like thing is only a stage in deconstructing the false perception of things, but then there is a more realistic one that fills that space. So an emptiness is equally the full space as the empty space, believe me. So, but they get confused by that experience, and then they run around acting foolish. And so we don't want to do that. Okay? So it's a kind of livelihood to have a yoga center, and it's a service, and it's a kind of therapeutic service for people. And it can be a spiritual service as well, for people who become more advanced. And even if it's for some of them, it's simply a health thing, it's, you know, or even an athletic thing or something, that's okay to sort of get started on being attuned to themselves, to inhabiting and occupying their own bodies in a way. So it's all right, that's a start. And then it might give them encouragement to go further. We will see. Some of you may already be yoga teachers. Some of you may already be Buddhists. I'm not sure. We'll slowly inventory that and stick with it. But beginner's mind, we'll work with those who are, we'll work with beginner's mind, you know, as the famous Zen master said, you know, he said, the Suzuki Roshi of the San Francisco Zen said, or I love that one thing, many things, but that one thing that he said, well, of course, everything is totally perfect. But there's always still a little room for improvement. I love that. I do love that. I don't know. I never heard him say. I never met him actually. Sadly, I'm open for questions. Yes? No? Okay, Michelle, do you have anything?
Perfect.
Okay, good. Did I cover most bases? I hope so. So I'm getting to that age where when I go somewhere and give a talk, I sort of just go ahead, you know. I don't make outlines, but I do kind of mentally make an outline. Different things pop up in my mind in the day or two before, and I especially wanted to focus on this not converting to Buddhism thing, and sort of having an attitude that whatever we're learning, it's everywhere. Like, I completely flipped out the last few days. I was with Ram Dass and I was with Jai Dev, you know, one Sikh group, and one Hanuman devotee group, you know, Baba Ram Dass and so forth. And I was totally getting their stuff, and I was reading, especially Guru Nanak, you know, the founder of Sikhism. He's like a Buddha. He's just like a Buddha. It's amazing. He has this thing called Mool Mantra, root mantra, that goes on for 40 verses at the beginning of their Bible, which has become the Bible of the Sikhs, S-I-K-H. And it's just like a Buddha, it's like any Tibetan Lama, or he was a contemporary of the second and third Dalai Lamas. He was in India, and in the middle of Hindu Islamic stress and tension, he created a new tradition that sort of met both of them and found the holy part of both of them. It was quite marvelous.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the ongoing Vajra Yoga Teacher Training Course, presented by Tibet House US, Menla, and the Yoga Space via Teachable. To learn more about this ongoing evergreen course, please visit menla.org. Tashi Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.